Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Shava, Vayelech Charana. Yaakov went out of Be'er Sheva, and he went to Charan. And here's one more pasuk, because I'm going to talk about both of them. Vayifga b'makom vayalen sham kiva hashemesh vayikach me'avnei hamakom vayosem mira'ashosov vayishkav b'makom hahu. Hard to translate, and you'll see why later. And he, Yaakov, encountered the place. Vayolen Shum, he slept there because the sun had set. He took from the stones of the place, and he placed them near his head, and he slept in that place.
OU Israel presents...
In. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayetze. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 7th day of Kislev, 5776, corresponding to November 19th. Sorry for getting a little confused there. Before we say anything else, let us do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli Tehiena Oznecha Kashuvot Lakol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmor Yah Adonai Miya Amod. Ki Imcha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare. Kiviti Adonai Kivita Nafshi Velidvoro Hochalti. Nafshi Ladonai Mishomarim Laboker Shomarim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbeimo Fedut. V'hu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. At this point, we usually say Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael. I want to introduce it with a mixed feeling. It is a little prayer to God to help and save all of our brethren wherever they are, in whatever type of tzaros, difficulties they find themselves in. And I have mentioned over many, many shows that I have in mind, among others, but a significant portion of my intent on that prayer was for Jonathan Pollard. I don't know the latest details. The scheduled date for his release, as far as I know, is tomorrow. November 20th, the 8th of Kislev, and that, on the face of it, would be a joyous occasion. Except for the fact that I had a visit in my office a couple of weeks ago from someone very close to him. I don't know if she wants me to mention the details here, so I will assume you know who I'm talking about, and give you a little bit of what she told me. This release from prison is not a joyous occasion, per se, because the conditions of parole are such that Jonathan continues to be a prisoner even though he will be outside the walls of the prison. For example, we have the count of number of days that Jonathan Pollard has been in prison. And the person in question asked me to continue that count even after his release. So it's a mixed feeling kind of thing. On the one hand, it's way, 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 way overdue in any form. On the other hand, the United States seems to still be playing a game by saying we kept him in prison for over 30 years, far, far longer than anyone else in a similar situation. And that's not enough. We are keeping him under our thumb for another 5 or 10 or 15 years. And it is, to put it in one word, obscene. So I say that it's a mixed feeling, and now we will say Achenu with the extra prayer that God helps out in this situation and somehow brings about or helps to bring about a real, complete, total release, including his return to Israel, where he wants to be. Achenu kol Beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yorachem alehem v'yotziem mitzara l'yurvacha, umeyafela l'ora, umishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Next on my mental list is a humble apology for once again not doing a show last week. It was so soon after the previous time that I bailed out. I felt extra bad. I just was so swamped with unscheduled meetings and other things for that Thursday that I had to give up something, and that's what it was, which I'm sorry for. I will try very, very hard and redouble my efforts not to have it happen again. Parshat Vayetze is an interesting sedra. First of all, if you look in a Torah scroll, you will see that the entire 148 verses of Vayetze, which is no small number, are contained in one single solid block of text, column after column after column, without a break. The breaks in a Torah come, well, first of all, there's a tiny, tiny break between words, but there are no indications of verses or chapters or even sedras of the week. The only breaks you find in a Torah scroll are called parsha, which comes in two forms, parsha petucha and parsha situma. A parsha, a portion, we'll call it. Not a weekly portion, but a portion. That sort of begins a new topic will usually be a parsha petucha, an open parsha. In a printed chumash, it will be marked with the letter pei at its beginning for petucha, open. And in a Torah scroll, it's not that marked that way, the previous parsha ends wherever it ends in the middle of a line, and then the rest of the line is left empty, and the new parsha petucha in question begins on its own line. A parsha situma is a portion which is more linked to the preceding parsha and therefore is less disconnected to it. In a printed chumash, a samach is used to indicate a parsha situma, and in a closed portion, and in a Torah scroll, the previous parsha ends on the beginning of a line, a blank space is left, and the new parsha, stuma in question, begins later on the same line. This has to be juggled sometimes by the one who writes the Sefer Torah so it happens properly. But it's pretty much been standardized now because most Sofrim copy from one special authoritative photocopy of a well-organized Torah. The point is that two things. Parshat Vayetze, the entire Parsha is one single portion of the Torah, no breaks within it, and it is a Parsha Situma, a closed portion, following on the same line with a blank space as Toledot ended, for good reason. You look at the end of Toledot, you have the dynamics of Rivka finding out that her son Esav intends to kill her son Yaakov after Yitzchak will die, and she needs to save her son Yaakov. She also does not want to tell Yitzchak that his son Esav is planning to murder, and therefore she doesn't drum up another reason. It's a legitimate reason. But what she tells her husband Yitzchak is that I do not want Yaakov, who is of marriageable age, to have a wife from the Kenaanim. And therefore, I would like you, his father, to send him to my hometown, to my family, and to find a suitable bride there. Yitzchak, at the end of Toledot, confirms the blessing which Yaakov had gotten in a little bit of a sneaky way, and gives him the blessing of Avraham, which he received from his father, and sends him on his way. So much does Vayetze follow that commentaries say, why are we saying again Vayetze Yaakov mibe'er shava Vayelech Charana? Sort of was already said. So there are explanations in the commentaries as to why. Here, at the very end of Toledot, Vayishma Yaakov el aviv ve'el imo, Yaakov listened to his father and mother, Vayelech Padan Aram, and he went towards Padan Aram, also known as Charan, in order to find a wife there. So here, at the beginning of Vayetze, it says, and Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and went to Charan. Commentaries explain that the going out from Be'er Sheva is really in fulfillment of his mother's wish that he should be safe from his brother Esav, and Vayelech Charana is fulfilling his father's desire that he should go to Charan to find a wife there. And of course that was Rivka's desire as well. So that's pretty much the first pasuk. There are other explanations as to the significance of telling us where Yaakov left from, but we won't get into that now. The second verse that I mentioned before, Vayivga b'makom vayolen shem kivo ha-shemesh, that portion of it is important in light of a drash. A drash goes outside the straightforward meaning of a verse into a more homiletical explanation. There is a Gemara in Masechet Brachot, the first volume of Talmud. It says there that prayers, the three-time-a-day prayer, were instituted by the patriarchs. Tfilot Avot Tiknum. And then another opinion, that prayer was instituted to correspond to sacrifice procedures in the Beit HaMikdash. Now, this is not a dispute where one is right and the other is wrong. This is showing us two aspects of our prayer. And I would suggest as follows. Our patriarchs and matriarchs set the tone for prayer morning, noon, and night, as we'll see in a moment. And that predates nationhood and certainly predates the Mikdash, the sanctuary. When the Beit HaMikdash existed, and I was going to say even more so, maybe not, just continuing, when it existed and in its aftermath until it's rebuilt and then continuing, prayer was linked to temple service. There was a morning sacrifice of a lamb, corresponding to which we pray Shacharit in the morning. There was a lamb brought in the afternoon. These two lambs were known as the Timidim, the always sacrifices. Corresponding to the afternoon one, we have Tfilat Mincha. And then, at night, parts and fats of the korbanot of the day were placed on the fires and coals of the altar to burn and simmer all night, corresponding to which we have Arvit. But each of those davenings, morning, afternoon, and night, have precedent based on the drash and the Gemara that goes way before, all the way back to the times of the Avot. Specifically, the Gemara tells us that Avraham, we attribute the institution of Shacharit to Avraham Avinu, because it says that Avraham approached God El Hamakom Asher Amad Sham, to the place where he stood. And another verse in Tanakh teaches us that standing is a synonym for prayer. In fact, the main portion of our tefillah, of our prayer, is known as the Amidah, the standing prayer, because we stand with our feet together and say it silently. Yitzchak, to him is attributed Mincha, because the Pasuk says, Vayetze Yitzchak, Lasuach basadeh, Yitzchak went out to commune in the field, to meditate, lifnot erev, before evening. And there is another verse in Tanakh that's quoted by the Gemara that says, Sicha, communing, is a synonym for prayer. In our case, in Parshat Vayetze, Vayivga, to encounter, to reach, to hit the place. Vayolen Shem Kivo HaShemesh, the sun had set, it was nighttime and dark, that's why Yaakov slept there. So again, the Gemara says, Paga, Vayivga, Ein Pigia, Ela Tfila. Pigia, that is another synonym for prayer. So we have a, let's call it a homiletical presentation in the Gemara that attributes the three davenings of the day, Shacharit, Mincha, and Arvit, to the patriarchs Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And, as I described before, also corresponding to temple sacrifice. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about Arvit, also known as Ma'ariv. Because that's the one that's pointed to in Vayetze. And there are a few things that people need to know. Number one, three-time-a-day prayer, morning, afternoon, and evening. I'm not discussing now the Musaf of Shabbat. That's another issue. Shabbat and Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh. I'm talking about the three times a day davening are obligatory for men, even though the origin of Arvit was more optional than obligatory. We'll get there in a moment. A man must, Jewish man, must daven in the morning, in the afternoon, and at night. There are specific time frames for tefillah. There's also an optimal time for tefillah, but those are details which we won't get into now. But that's an obligation. Women are obligated in prayer, but there are various opinions as to how specific. Their obligation applies to Shachrit, Mincha, and or Ma'ariv. Women's obligation of prayer is a good topic by itself, which we're not doing now, but basically most authorities agree that Ma'ariv is not an obligation for women. It's optional, and if they do it, they should do it without taking it as a commitment. And Shachrit and Mincha, some say both, and some say just one. But again, I say it's a bigger topic, which we're not going to go into in detail. The bottom line on Arvit, and now, so obligation-wise, I'm talking about men, but optional by women also. I mentioned earlier that the history of Arvit was less obligatory, and that could be seen in another factor, and that is that at Shacharit and Mincha, we have a repetition of the Chazan, where he repeats the entire Amidah out loud with a Kedusha, and there is no such thing at Ma'ariv. To understand that, you have to go back to the history of the repetition of the Amidah. Originally, it was not a repetition. The silent Amidah had one major drawback, namely that if you knew how to say it, you were okay, and if you didn't know how to say it, you were out of luck, because Sidurim, prayer books as we know them in the days before printing, were very hard to come by. They were all very expensive, and they were handwritten, and most of prayer by most people was done by heart. So what is a person to do if he just doesn't know the prayer by heart? So at Shacharit and at Mincha, there was a procedure that the Chazan would, the Shaliach Tzibur, would say his silent Amidah out loud while those in the congregation who knew how to daven would say theirs silently. And those who didn't know how to pray would listen to the Chazan answer Amen at the end of each bracha, and with intention to fulfill the mitzvah, the answering of Amen is considered equivalent to saying it. Oneh kimivarech. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah to be told for Parshat Vayetzi. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Vayetze. The theme music on the beginning of the first half, the beginning of the show, I leave someone to figure out. And the one from here, which is probably much more recognizable, I won't explain because I'm a little embarrassed to have chosen it for this Sedra, but we'll leave it as just the introduction. In any event, I was in the middle of an idea that, because Arvit does not correspond in the time of the Beit HaMikdash to a specific sacrifice, but rather is the more nebulous hekter chalavim ve'evarim, the simmering of various parts and fats on the Mizbeach, as I mentioned earlier, the davening of Ma'ariv had a more nebulous kind of identity. I don't know if that's the right wording. Just to show you the difference, when the Mishnah speaks of Tfilat HaShachar, the morning davening, Ad Arba Sha'ot, according to Rabbi Yehuda, or Ad Chatzot, according to Tanakama, and Mincha, from Sheisha'ot Umechza, specific timing. When it asks about Arvit, it says, Tfilat Arvit Ein La Keva. It's not fixed. It's not fixed is defined as you can daven Ma'ariv all night, but by its nature, it was not as fixed into the requirement early on as it is now, and as the other davenings always had been. And therefore, the difference in Myriv shows itself in what I spoke about earlier, that most hold that women are not obligated on Myriv, in the lack of a Chazarat HaShatz in Kedusha, because if you didn't know how to daven it by heart, then you didn't have to daven. That's changed. It's obligatory now. So let's continue on this, because I think it's an important idea to review. And I know that, you know, some of the listeners of the show are religious and probably do daven Myriv, as well as the other davenings, so maybe they're not learning as much new things, as much new stuff. But I think it's important to review. And for those people who don't daven every day, you know, give it a try. It's when I say that something is required by Judaism, I sometimes get corrected by somebody who will say, no, that's Orthodox Judaism. And I say, no, that's wrong. It is Judaism that requires davening. It is Judaism that requires strict observance of Shabbat. It is Judaism that requires strict adherence to the laws of Kashrut. It is Judaism that requires the mitzvot and halakha. You can't say that it's Orthodox Judaism, because that's a false The term Orthodox Judaism came into existence in contrast to conservative Judaism, Reform Judaism, Reconstructionist Judaism, secular Judaism, humanitarian Judaism, or whatever. There's really only one Judaism. Now, obviously, I'm looking at it from, I hate to say it, the Orthodox perspective. But from the Orthodox perspective, Torah observant perspective, halakha is a requirement of all Jews. A person can't say, I'm not religious, therefore I'm allowed to eat non-kosher. No, you are Jewish. You're not allowed to eat non-kosher. You choose to violate that, and you eat non-kosher. But I have to view you, whoever you are, as a Jew who is not allowed to eat non-kosher. I had a situation a long time ago in graduate school where I went to a candy machine and the question mark column, and a candy came out that wasn't kosher. And the guy that I was standing next to said, I'll take it. I don't keep kosher. I said, if you're Jewish, I can't give it to you. He says, what do you mean? It doesn't apply to me. I said, of course it applies to you. Anyway, that's a deviation. So Myriv is Myriv. And the other thing that's important to mention about Arvit, Myriv, is that our sages had a great idea about Shachrit and about Arvit. They had, on the one hand, a requirement to pray three times a day, morning, afternoon, and night. And we have a mitzvah in the Torah to recite the Shema twice a day, in the morning when people arise, and at night when people go to sleep. So the sages way back said, got a great idea. Let's combine the prayer of the morning with the Shema of the morning, and the prayer of the evening with the Shema of the evening. Mincha does not have that same opportunity to link up with a mitzvah like Shema, and that's why Mincha is much shorter than Myriv, and Myriv is shorter even than Shacharit. I mean, but the little one is Mincha, because it's only a prayer, where Shacharit, Chazal, our sages, had this great idea of combining the two. So they packaged the Shema. Let's go again, talk about nighttime. They took the Shema, which is required after dark, and they said, we are going to build a structure that the davening will help the reciting of Shema, and the reciting of Shema will help the davening. So they took the Shema, and they preceded it with two blessings, and followed it with two blessings, and then required that whole piece of Kriyat Shema u'Birchoteha, Shema and its brachot, to lead into the Amidah of Arvit. And that's pretty much what we have. So when one davens Ma'ariv, he is simultaneously, almost simultaneously, fulfilling the mitzvah to recite Shema at night. And this is not talking about the Shema that one says when he actually gets into bed and goes to sleep. This is right after dark. He fulfills the Torah's requirement of reciting the Shema, the full three passages, and the requirement of davening Ma'ariv at night. Which brings me back for a moment to the woman's side of this. A woman is exempt from the reciting of Shema because it is strictly a time-related positive mitzvah. A woman is generally considered also to be exempt from Ma'ariv, Arvit, the nighttime davening, which means on two scores they don't have to daven Ma'ariv. However, Arvit contains a mitzvah that does apply to women, and that is the fulfillment of the mitzvah to remember the exodus from Egypt all the days of your life. As we say in the Haggadah of Pesach, days of your life would be daytime. All the days of your life includes day as well as night. So we have in the final verse of the Shema a reference to Yetziat Mitzrayim, to the Exodus. We have the bulk of the after brachot of Shema deal with Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. And that's a good reason to daven Ma'ariv, to fulfill yet another mitzvah. And it might even be a good push for a woman when she reaches that age and family situation where she's not swamped with work at night and has the opportunity, not a bad idea to daven Ma'ariv. It's a good thing to do. One woman should not take her exemption of Shema and not say it, because the Shema, day and night, is a restatement of one's belief in God and in His unity, an acceptance of one upon oneself of the yoke of heaven, and the side additional fulfillment of remembering the Exodus all the days of your life. And in between, you have the passage that deals with the acceptance of the yoke of mitzvot, all of which would apply to a woman. So she has the technical exemption, but she has a recommendation, if she's got the time and energy at night, to give it a try.
Okay, very disappointing. I just spent a lot of time trying to put in a lovely song I found on YouTube called Kihem Chayenu, which is from the Ma'ariv Davening, from the second bracha before Kriyat Shema. I really liked it. I heard it a bunch of times while I'm trying to convert it to an MP3 and have not been able to do it yet, so we'll have to go without it. Now I'm way behind schedule, so I hope I'll be able to finish up. I want to look at another aspect of Vayetze. We got stuck on the second pasuk, which is the connection to Arvit, but now let's take an overview of the entire Sedra. I started the show by saying that we're dealing with one parsha, one neat, complete story of a round trip. The Sedra begins with Yaakov leaving Be'er Sheva and leaving Eretz Yisrael. At the border, he spends time sleeping and meditating and receives the famous dream of the ladder with its feet on the ground, leading heavenward, angels going up and down the ladder, God on top of the ladder, above the ladder, and makes a deal with God. At the very end of the Sedra, Yaakov is on his way back finally to Eretz Yisrael 20 or so years later, and he sees a vision of camps, two camps of angels. And on both ends of the parsha, the commentaries explain that there are angels that accompany someone in Eretz Yisrael, and different angels in Chutz Laretz. This was the changing of the guard that he was experiencing, so to speak, and it marked a very, very sharp distinction between living in Eretz Yisrael and living in Chutz Laretz. And that's one of the messages here. Yaakov goes out. He goes out apparently with a decent amount of provisions and money, and is attacked, according to our sources, not written in the words here, is attacked by Eliphaz, son of Esav. Esav, who has tried his hardest to get at Yaakov, and now is having his son, and later his grandson, Amalek, filling them with the same venom towards brother Yaakov, and the same desire to vanquish. And according to our sources in Midrash, the Eliphaz takes all of Yaakov's possessions, leaving him totally penniless, and that is considered equivalent to being dead. So he goes on his way, and he encounters sheep being brought by their shepherds to a well. The well is covered with a big rock. And in conversation with them, he determines that these sheep belong to the family of Rivka's family. Hold on. I didn't really mean to tell you to hold on. I just had to answer the phone, so I cut the recording. But I'm not getting rid of that part anyway. In any event, while he's talking to the shepherds, he sees in the distance, so they say, Lavan, who is brother of Rivka, in other words, uncle to Yaakov. He says, Lavan's daughter Rachel is coming, first cousin of Yaakov, and he falls in love with her and goes to Lavan's house. I'm not telling the whole thing. It's in the Parsha. He agrees to work for Lavan for 7 years for Rachel's hand in marriage. And there's a switch that Lavan engineers, but according to our tradition, was, part conspiracy that the girls themselves, Leah and Rachel, brought in. He marries Rachel and then promises to work another 7 years for Rachel, marries Leah, then Rachel, and each come with a handmaiden. And in due time, although very rapid fire in the psukim, his family grows with the births of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda to Leah. Rachel is barren and complains to Yaakov, and gives Yaakov her handmaiden, Bilhah, to father a child with her, and Rachel would raise him as her own. The two children born to Bilhah from Yaakov are Dan and Naphtali. Leah, having been guided, according to our sources, by a holy Ruach HaKodesh, who knew that there had to be many children there, had stopped giving birth and gave her handmaiden Zilpah, who bore two more children for Yaakov, namely Gad and Asher. Then Leah continues to give birth to Yisachar and Zvulun, and then gives birth to a daughter, Dinah, and finally Rachel is blessed with a child, who is Yosef. We know that coming up, not in this parsha, will be a second child to Rachel, and she dies in childbirth that time with Binyamin. But Nachon L'Achshav, at this point in Parshat Vayetze, we've got 11 sons and daughter Dinah, two mothers Leah and Rachel, Yosef, and Bilhah and Zilpah. And then, after the birth of Yosef, Yaakov asks to take leave of Lovin's house, and there is a deal as to what his compensation will be, and a very sort of enigmatic portion about Lovin trying to pull a fast one over Yaakov, and Yaakov, with angel-assisted advice, thwarting Lovin's plan each time and ending up making more sheep for him than would be if Lovin had left things alone. And Yaakov is ready to leave with a large entourage, which he does. I mean, that's the short side of the Parsha. But there are a lot of things that we see in here. We see the beginning of the sibling rivalry between Rachel and Leah, which will translate to the next generation of the brothers from Leah against Yosef from Rachel, and the sale of Yosef and his eventual coming down into Egypt. That's still two sedras away in Vayeshev, but the seeds are planted for that. We see the sharp contrast between Avraham, who waited so long to have a child, and then when he had Yishmael from Hagar, thought that that was the child that God had promised, and God assured him that he would have a child from Sarah, and it would be through Yitzchak of Sarah that would be the descent of spiritual as well as material descent of Avraham through Yitzchak and not through Yishmael. And then Yitzchak, who had a very long time until Yaakov and Esav were born, and the split between Yaakov, who received the blessing of Avraham, and Esav, who went on his own to a totally different kind of life. And you see, unfortunately, or whatever, the seeds of the strong enmity that exists between Esav and Yaakov. Lovin is the character. Excuse me. Lovin is the one in Parshat Vayetze who we later refer to as the deceitful one, and he's the one who's got the history of smiling at Yaakov and trying to stab him in the back at the same time. It started way back when our tradition tells us that he attempted to poison Eliezer so that his sister Rivka would not become the wife of Yitzchak in the family of Avraham, and that didn't work. And then his attempts to mess with Yaakov didn't work, and God actually appears to him in a dream and tells him to stay away from Yaakov and not to harm one thing about him, and we see that as well. It is interesting to note that previously in the Torah, back with Avraham's brother Nachor having 8 children from his wife Milcah and another 4 from his concubine, his Pelegesh, and Reuma, and having a full family when Avraham was struggling, and then the description of Yishmael's lineage with 12 descendants from him, and Yitzchak is still struggling. And then we have the description coming up of Esav's lineage, and our Jewish origins here are struggling so mightily to bring a nation into existence. So from Avraham only to eventual Yitzchak, not Yishmael. From Yitzchak only to Yaakov and not Esav. And Yaakov in this Sedra is where we see the burgeoning family, which will become the nation, which is probably why we call the nation B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, even though we descend from Avraham and Yitzchak as well. As a matter of fact, there's a very nice, whatever you want to call it, a play on the name Yisrael, which he doesn't even have yet. Yisrael, Yud, Sin, Resh, Aleph, Lamed, is the initial letters of all of the patriarchs and matriarchs. The Yud stands for Yitzchak and Yaakov. The Sin for Sarah. The Resh for Rivka and Rachel. The Aleph for Avraham. And the Lamed for Leah. So you have three forefathers and four mothers. And they're all covered in the word Yisrael, which becomes the word that describes the Jewish people throughout history. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehish Tameah.